This is Film Weekly, and I'm Jason Solomons. This week we get lost in paradise with Timothy Oliphant. Yes, I'll be speaking to the man made famous by the HBO series Deadwood, who's slowly becoming hot property in Hollywood. And following last week's Sin Nombre, there's another notable US directing debut. Antonio Campos will be joining me to discuss his new film, After School, a story of teen paranoia, YouTube clips and death in an East Coast prep school. Zan Brooks is back. Zan and I will be getting our teeth into the film of the week, Inglourious Basterds, a war pastiche by Quentin Tarantino, and then Brian De Palma's gangster pastiche, Scarface, gets a well-deserved dust-off and reissue this week. Yes, it's the original movie mashup. It's Film Weekly.
You know, it crossed my mind, and it crossed your mind, that we're the ones, me and Gina.
The ones who...
It's okay, Cliff. That's your screenplay writer mind working its magic. You gotta think like that.
What? The killers?
The gruesome twosome.
You know, I think your mind's spinning, Nick.
So you think it's just a coincidence we were there at the same time, on Oahu?
Just like Sydney and I were there.
Just a lot of people on Oahu when the murders happened. That's the way you look at it.
That's exactly how I look at it, Nick.
Good.
Timothy Oliphant starring in a scene from A Perfect Getaway, a new thriller about couples stranded on a mountain trail in Hawaii. It co-stars Steve Zahn and Mila Jovovich, and Timothy Oliphant has come down from his Hawaiian mountain to join me on the line from Los Angeles now. Timothy Oliphant, welcome to Film Weekly. Lovely to have you on the line from Los Angeles, where I think you're in your house making coffee, which is very nice and relaxed.
It is very nice and relaxed. Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
It's an absolute pleasure. And the reason I'm having you is because I saw you in A Perfect Getaway last week.
How'd it go?
Oh, well, I thought it was great. What a fun movie. Well, I'm telling just you and me at the moment, but hopefully a few listeners will pick up on it, because I thought your performance in it was great. You seem to know the game that it was at. You knew it was a kind of a B movie genre exercise movie with a good little twist. Was it fun to make?
Yeah, I did know. You know what I did? I read the script. This seems like it could be fun.
Because your career is taking off. Each time I see you, I think, oh, great, that's Timothy Oliphant. I'd like to look out for him. But you've actually been sort of going for a very long time, Timothy. Am I right?
I have been working a long time. I'm glad that you have that response. I'm trying to get out there and make a living.
Yeah. you're also having a great time at the moment in Deadwood, of course, opposite our own Ian McShane.
Yeah, well, that's something special, Deadwood. You know, the writing was unbelievable.
And that's opened. So. Did that open saloon doors for you?
You know, it did. I'm sure it did. It was. You know, it's always great to be a part of something that that you're proud of and that people certainly pay attention to. And it was. You know, if nothing else, it was creatively, artistically, it was an incredible experience and very inspiring. And you know, I learned a great deal from. Working with David Milch, working with those other actors like Ian, and that job just keeps on giving. It's been a few years since we wrapped that up, but I still think about it and refer to it all the time.
It's an interesting bunch of actors as well, because of course Ian McShane, who's been acting on British television for years and years and years, and has sort of enjoyed high points and low points, but he's always been working. I don't know if you're aware of his career, but you know he was kind of touted as a big thing back in the sort of early 70s in films, and then then he disappeared, and then he was in an 80s TV show called Lovejoy, which is a kind of a little kind of genteel antiques dealer kind of guy.
Yeah.
And then you enjoy those. Have you talked about him about longevity in careers? In acting and how you know
we talk a bit. I mean, the fact is, I was very aware when making that show. I was surrounded by guys like that, guys that had been around, and with Ian or Brad Dourif or Bill Sanderson or Powers Booth, and you know all these guys that you know I grew up watching, and they were still showing up every day, really thrilled and really enthusiastic, and I just got a great deal out of that.
Yeah,
And I think after that show wrapped, I felt like, and I hope I'm right about this, it felt like a lot of what I saw and what I experienced kind of started to sink in a bit.
Yeah, and I think that showing as well, with the kind of wide variety of roles you pick. Of course, I see you in Damages, the recent episodes of Damages in there, which you kind of worked on too. It's great movie stars you worked with in there, with Glenn Close and Rose Byrne.
Yeah, that's another one.
Great class.
Just unbelievable.
And then you turn up in A Perfect Getaway, which it may not be a massive movie, but you have Steve Zahn and Mila Jovovich, and you know there's a great kind of sense of play in that movie.
Oh, it was
which
a great
really
cast, and you know with Steve, you know all of them actually, you know Keeley and Mila as well. You really felt like you're really playing ball, and you just didn't know what to expect from one take to the next, and everybody was right there to pick up the ball.
It's a great career you have, because what you're managing to do, Timothy, it seems to me, is you're balancing bad guy roles. I mean, I'm thinking, you know, of the kind of sort of fey baddie you played up against Bruce Willis in Live Free or Die Hard, the fourth Die Hard movie, and then in Perfect Getaway, you're kind of a baddie, or people kind of assume you're a baddie, but you're not necessarily a baddie. You kind of manage to have this kind of glint in your eye that you may be good, you may be evil.
Yeah, that's what the job called for. Yeah. I mean, you know, I've been really lucky. I've been really lucky to go, especially lately, to be able to go back and forth from playing heroic roles or villain roles. And
what are the actors when you are an actor like you in Los Angeles, and you kind of, you know, really worked the last sort of, I know, since your IMDb entry goes back to, you know, a Scooby-Doo episode in 1996. So you must be pleased with that.
That's
one.
The first job in 96.
Is that true?
Yeah. I'm getting up there.
Right. So, I mean, you've been working, you know, it was like, well, we're all working. You've been in Sex and the City, and I'm sure completists on that will know exactly which part you did in that.
Sex and the City. Oh, I encourage you to look it up.
I will. My wife will be
on the very first episode.
My wife will be delighted if I have to say I'm an elephant completist, and I just have to look at old episodes of Sex and the City. She'll be like, yeah, let's get on it.
It was a good job. Basically, I was living in New York at the time, and I'd walk across town and make out with Sarah Jessica Parker for about half the day, and and then I'd turn in and go back the next day and make out with Sarah Jessica Parker for another half the day. Then when the show came out, I felt like, I was like, wait a second, everybody's making out with her. I felt really cheated.
Well, I'm sure she still talks about you, Timothy.
I'd like to think so. That's nice. You know,
but what I'm saying is that when you're working your way up as an actor, who are the people you admire? But as most actors we talk to, they sort of say, well, of course, I love Gary Oldman, I love Tim Roth, I love Al Pacino, I love Robert De Niro. But you have a slightly sort of older movie star quality to you, Timothy, if I may say. You're sort of, you have more of a Jimmy Stewart kind of gait to you. You have more of a, my producer thinks you have a Clint Eastwood sort of stillness to you,
I mean, those guys are the guys. I mean, those careers and those lives mean a great deal to me. And you know, I remember when I was first starting out, I remember my acting teacher telling me, you know, give yourself about 10 years and then you'll get good at it. And I feel like, you know, I just sort of crossed that line a few years ago, and I'm enjoying my career more than ever. And like I said, when we were working on Deadwood, for example, and working with Brad Dourif and Ian McShane, I have a great admiration and respect for these guys that have made a life out of, you know, a career over a lifetime. And that's always been the plan.
But it's an interesting plan, because there's so many have it so quickly, you know, there's so many young stars in Hollywood.
I wouldn't wish it on my worst enemy. Yeah. You know, I really, you know, and look, just to some degree, I guess I could look back at some jobs I've done and said, you know, if the movie was really successful, then maybe I would have been burdened with more success quickly, and to some degree I feel like I dodged some bullets. And on the other hand, I feel like at times I purposely have kind of just said, you know what, I'm good, I'll just sit this next one out and let it go a little slower. Now what's great about that is, now if I'm not prepared for any kind of great success now, I'll never will be. And it makes it really fun to still be going to work, and I feel like I'm enjoying my job more than ever.
Well, I'm certainly enjoying you every time you pop up. In fact, The Perfect Getaway, which is a film I didn't really know much about, but when I saw that your name was on it, and Steve Zahn is another actor who I always enjoy, whatever film it is, you kind of, you think, well, it's going to be fine. Zahn's always amusing, even in Daddy Daycare.
That guy's just money. He really is just so good. And I think, I don't know if it's fair to say he's underrated, because I think a lot of people like yourself are kind of dialed into just how good he is. I know he's played a lot of kind of comedic sort of sidekick roles, but man, he's just, He's just really, the top of his game.
Yeah.
He's extremely, extremely good.
And I
really
thought the two of you worked really well together as, talking of a comic pairing. I thought the two of you worked really well together. The kind of
I'd work with him in a heartbeat. And if I had another opportunity to do something with him, I'd do it in a second.
Well, maybe our listeners will send in a script if it's like a slightly kind
yeah,
of
please do.
Tall and small kind of thing going on, which we love. Timothy, you said 10 years you're getting the hang of it. I think you are just about getting the hang of it, and congratulate you on that, and on A Perfect Getaway, which UK audiences can see now. We look forward to the forthcoming films. You mentioned High Life and The Crazies, of course, and with a flourishing career. Thanks very much for joining us on Film Weekly, Timothy Oliphant.
It was a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And you can catch Timothy Oliphant's A Perfect Getaway on UK-wide release now. Zan Brooks joins me in the studio to review this week's releases, or only some of this week's releases, Zan, because we've got two major things that we need to discuss. The first being Quentin Tarantino's Inglourious Basterds, I pronounce it as he writes it, and then we're going to talk about Brian De Palma's Scarface as well, two classic directors of American film. We'll start with Tarantino and Inglourious Basterds. Now, I know some of you might say, I've heard you and Zan, do this from Cannes. You've been talking about Tarantino since May. Well, it's finally out on release here in the UK, and I think deserves a second review and a second watch. For me, personally, I've just seen it again. I think that that Tarantino in Cannes is a different beast to Tarantino on general release, and I think a lot of films in Cannes are so under the spotlight and crammed up in that competition that when a film like Inglourious Basterds comes along that's so not a European art house movie, that's so not about sort of some poor indigenous farmer trying to work his fingers to the bone in some foreign field, that we think, well, this has no place in Cannes. So I think it sort of skews the kind of aesthetic and kind of tone of it. So having seen it again now, I have to say I enjoyed it immensely the second
really?
Time
round. So you are a different person to the Cannes you.
I am older.
There's London
wiser.
Jason and there's Cannes Jason.
That's right.
Well, never the twain.
Well, given that Tarantino himself said this was such a Cannes movie and that he had to put the film out in Cannes because it's in French, it's in German, it refers to Pabst and Leni Riefenstahl and all these kind of cinematic references. There, a Pabst joke gets cheered to the rafters, here perhaps not. But maybe because I knew what was coming, or I knew what not to expect about this film. Just before you throw your tuppence worth in, Zan, let's have a little listen to the film. As far as we know, it's about a group of Jewish American commandos who've been sent into Nazi-occupied France. They're led by Brad Pitt. The rest of them are Jewish Avengers. One of them is the Bear Jew, played by Eli Roth. In the clip we're going to hear, Eli Roth's beating someone over the head with a baseball bat. Nazi soldiers are getting it as they deserve, and Brad Pitt is relishing the torture of one particular Nazi.
Up the road a piece, there's an orchard. Besides you, we know there's another crowd patrol fucking around here somewhere. If that patrol were to have any crack shots, that orchard would be a goddamn sniper's delight. So if you ever want to eat a sauerkraut sandwich again, you gotta show me on this here map where they are. You gotta tell me how many they are, and you gotta tell me what kind of artillery they're carrying with them.
You can't expect me to divulge information that would put German lives in danger.
Well, now, Werner, that's where you're wrong, because that's exactly what I expect. I need to know about Germans hiding in trees. And you need to tell me. And you need to tell me right now.
I respectfully refuse, sir.
Actually, Werner, we're all tickled to hear you say that. Quite frankly, watching Donnie beat Nazis to death is close we ever get to going to the movies. Donnie!
Yeah?
Got a German here wants to die for the country. Oblige him.
Brad Pitt as Lieutenant Aldo Rain there, named after Aldo Ray, the Italian actor, of course, a Tarantino in-joke as well. While that story's going on, Zan, of course, there's another story of a Jewish revenge in that Shoshana, played by Melanie Laurent, is now owns a cinema in Paris where the Nazi high command, the top four, are assembling, and she's going to blow them all up in the cinema. It is a bit of a balmy plot.
It's a balmy plot. It's this is Tarantino's self-styled spaghetti Western war movie, which I think basically means it's World War II as seen by Quentin Tarantino, for good and for bad. I'm not like you in that I'm not going to roll back on my dislike of this film from Cannes. I still kind of dislike it.
Right. I'm not saying I'm rolling back. I'm not saying that I now think it's brilliant. I think parts of it are brilliant, as I did in Cannes. I sort of enjoyed watching it in Cannes, but came out thinking, you're just quite a silly boy, though, aren't you, Tarantino? And I still think he's a bit silly.
It is very silly. Tarantino is talented. I would defend him, and I'd even defend him with something like Kill Bill, which yeah. a lot of people really didn't like.
No, that's okay. It's pretty good, though.
Bill I really like. Yeah, I loved Kill Bill. This, I think, is too kind of smart and self-obsessed and solipsistic for its own good. It's spoiled. It's a bit brattish.
Hence the French liking it very much.
Well, and also, yeah, and in a way, you're saying that it sort of stuck out in Cannes, but it tried to cozy up to yeah. the Cannes jury, I thought, with like this kind of obsequious tribute to sort of French cinema on the auteur theory yeah. and, you know, the power of cinema to liberate France and kill Hitler.
It's slightly silly, isn't it? Because what we like about Tarantino is his freshness, is the fact that he's postmodern. Yeah. That he doesn't actually sort of have the same kind of smooth camera work as a Jean Renoir or a G.W. Papp or a Leni Riefenstahl. The fact is that he can do the jokes. So to actually try and kind of mimic them is a bit of a shame. It's reining his own talents in, I think.
It is, really. And you kind of think, does Tarantino really like these films? I mean, you know, he likes grindhouse-type yeah. movies. That's his touchstone. So to have him sort of, you know, loftily pontificating on how in France they respect the auteur and things like that, just, it struck a bit of a weird note.
Well, I think so, but there is still much in the movie that I mind. The opening sequence, of course, where Christophe Waltz, who went on to win the Best Actor in Cannes, goes to interrogate Mr. Perrier-Lapadite. I mean, the name is even stupid itself. The French farmer where the Jews are hiding underneath his floors. It is fantastic. And watching it again a second time, it's like, you know, a jazz piece that you know really well. And he's just playing the riffs again. And I thought it worked magnificently.
The opening scene is brilliant. And this is a weird paradox that I have with this film, that I think that it's incredibly overlong and flabby. And yet the two key scenes in it are perhaps the longest scenes.
Yeah.
It's the opening scene in the farmhouse, which is like a kind of nightmare version of those old Stella Artois ads that were itself a ripoff of Jean de Florette.
Yes.
And that's kind of spun on its head. And the tension is unbearable. And the other scene in which the tension is unbearable is the scene in the basement tavern with Michael Fassbender and Diane Kruger. Again, those are kind of masterclasses, and they both go on for seemingly kind of 20 minutes.
Yeah, well, he calls them chapters. I mean, each sort of scene opens up, the chapter one, the chapter two, three and four, I think. It feels to me like that whilst it was very long, and my bum, even in the comfortable seats that we were afforded as critics at the Odeon Leicester Square, my bum was numb the second time round. I have
yeah.
to say. However, in the very, very odd circumstances, I thought there was quite a bit missing of this film. There's a lot more that needs to be in there for it to be a really good film.
I agree. And so much of it doesn't work.
Absolutely.
So much of it really doesn't work so spectacularly that you lose patience with it and you become really deeply irritated with it. I know it's a film that he's been nurturing for a long time and wanting to make for a long time, but for all that, it felt like a film that was being kind of scripted as it was being shot, that they're kind of like, now what are we going to do? What are we going to do today? Well, let's have the story going in this way. And in some ways, that gives it a kind of turbulence and an interest, because you're thinking, I've really no idea where we're yeah. going here. But in another level, you do lose patience with it.
And there's a comedy Führer in there, which shouts 99999
yeah, like
stands beneath his portrait. But there are some great little... The linguistically, I thought it was very spry. I mean, I loved Christoph Waltz, who speaks German and French and English and switches between the two, and he uses a kind of rarefied French, afin que nous puissions parler, very polite and studied. And I thought that actually was kind of, I haven't really seen a film that does that. Amazing that it's Tarantino.
Christoph Waltz is, I think, the best thing in the film. He, from what I can gather, is a sort of veteran of German soap operas. And here he comes out of nowhere and really does upstage Brad Pitt, who I think doesn't quite know what he's doing in this film,
or
certainly
feeling.
Tarantino doesn't know what he's meant to be doing in this film. And Christoph Waltz strikes just the right note of being wildly over the top, but utterly in control.
The other debate about Tarantino that your large friend Harvey might be interested in, is this going to be a hit for him?
No, I sort of suspect not. I think it's not going to be a flop. It's not going to be like Grindhouse, which they didn't know quite how to handle it, they didn't know how to release it, and they kind of fumbled it.
Yeah.
I think this will do decent business, but I don't think it's going to be electrifying.
No, I can't see it either. I think it's sort of too clever for itself, too clever to be a hit. And there's no one really, you know, Brad Pitt, who's, I'm going to see that Brad Pitt movie. He's not really in it that
no,
much, is he?
No, they're not going to say, let's go and see that Christoph Waltz movie.
Not yet, Tazan, but one best
All those fans of German soaps are going to be queuing up
around the block. That's Quentin Tarantino's Inglourious Basterds. See it if you dare. One film that you've probably seen already, but it is wonderful to see it on the big screen. I'm not sure I've ever seen it on the big screen. Re-released this week for no reason in particular, other than the fact that I think it's a sort of rather enormous monument to American cinema.
I think it's the grand 26th anniversary.
The 26th anniversary. Yeah. Why not? Let's hear from Scarface, that beautiful Giorgio Moroder score. Say hello to a good old friend.
Okay, so what do you call yourself? Eh? Como se llama?
Antonio Montana. And you? What you call yourself?
Where'd you learn to speak the English, Tony?
In a school. And my father, he was from the United States. Yeah, just like you, you know. He was a Yankee. He used to take me a lot to the movies, you know. I learned. I watched the guys like Humphrey Bogart, James Cagney. They teach me to talk. I like those guys. I always know one day I'm coming here, United States.
Zan, what is it that when you think about Scarface, you think of immediately?
I think it's the cocaine binges and the machine gun rampage.
I'm not talking about what you do on Saturday night. So what do you think about Scarface?
That was many years ago and they couldn't convict me. I think it's those are sort of indelible moments of 80s cinema.
Aren't they?
And I remember watching that as a sort of callow youngster and really thinking, my God, is that what the world is like? And it is, as we know.
Yes, it is, absolutely. I've just come fresh from seeing a German film as well this week called Chico, which is actually quite good. It stars Moritz Bleibtreu as this kind of underworld boss. But it's complete homage to Scarface. Mm. They're still doing it. It's about this little kind of Turkish immigrant who wants to become the boss, and it's all about respect, and then he goes high on his own supply. I mean, that is, you know, 26 years later, they're still throwing out the kind of...
Well, it's a real perennial, isn't it? And the story is as old as the hills. In a way, it's a kind of... It's a warped Horatio Alger story, isn't it? It's
absolutely.
The rags to riches, and it's the American dream, but that then becomes the nightmare. So it's Al Pacino as Tony Montana, who's the Cuban refugee who comes to Florida and ends up in the refugee camp under the freeway and then sort of claws his way to the summit. And again, you know, that's been done before. Scarface is a remake of the 30s Scarface. It's like the old Jimmy Cagney films, you know, like you know, where it's Top of the World.
Yeah, White Heat.
White Heat and then The Fall. You know, you have to have The Fall.
Absolutely, and it's a spectacular film. But I mean, I think De Palma must have been attracted to making this film. As I was watching it again, the shapes of it, again, the kind of The Fall where it's, he's at the top of the staircase, isn't he? It's all about spirals. And De Palma's a filmmaker who sometimes I regard very highly, and sometimes I think is, again, like Tarantino, slightly like he's got too many tricks in his pram and throws them out.
Yes, I think you're right. I think
but in Scarface, I do think they come together very well.
They do come together. Weirdly, I think this is a film that's improved with age. At the time, I think it was seen as a bit of a kind of sleazy 1980s kind of knockoff job,
yes.
Really.
I think
it's not the Godfather.
And it doesn't have the score. I think it's a lot to do with the score, because it used an electronic score,
yes.
Which is very modern, and so critics would say, people, rather than a nice Nino Rota kind of score. So, I mean, I think a lot of that electronicness and that kind of brashness, which is what the film's about, really, probably it was a bit of a parvenu of a film about a parvenu itself.
Yeah, I mean, the temptation, I think, particularly since Coppola's The Godfather, is to make a grand epic of these lives.
Yeah.
And this is a film of kind of cheap and tawdry
Isn't
glamour,
it?
And it wallows in it. You know, De Palma, I think maybe all directors are slightly attracted by it. Even, you know, someone like Scorsese with Goodfellas, which is the closest cousin to this film, and that it shows that kind of seedy glamour of it, and then the abyss that you're pitched into. I think all these filmmakers are attracted and repulsed. And I think perhaps De Palma is more attracted than he is repulsed.
Yes.
And he does kind of coming up smelling slightly suspect. But in a way that works fine.
Yeah,
because that's what this film is
but
about.
But it is about the attraction, I think. And there's that wonderful scene where, it's almost Shakespearean, isn't it? Where Al Pacino sees Michelle Pfeiffer for the first time. She's the lady in green at the top. And he wants to attain that height.
Yeah,
and
she's the perfect American beauty.
A very strange looking beauty to have cast, actually.
A very strange looking beauty. But again, one of those films that dates it. It's so 80s. Her look is so 80s. And it's that weird way that you get your sex symbol. Each generation gets a sex symbol that they kind of need or deserve.
Yeah.
And there's no, you could take her out of that era and she would die a death in any other decade. But there she is the ideal.
I do wonder why more people haven't gone for that Michelle Pfeiffer in Scarface look. You know what I mean? As a femme fatale, I think this is really well defined, as you say, 80s femme fatale.
Yeah.
Something very kind of sort of hard about her. There's no voluptuousness. Exactly. And the score, I think, is sort of, you know, always brilliant, kind of influenced dance music from, you know, till now. So my favourite bit, though, my favourite character is Ricardo Montalban.
Oh, yeah.
Who is Tony, who let me down so badly. I love him.
I think
he's just brilliant. Yeah. And those are the people that he can never aspire to be, the educated Tony. He's always so disappointed with you, Tony.
Yeah, whereas Pacino is representing a new breed of gangster. who's the basically the little rat on the make.
Exactly. That Scarface by Brian De Palma, I think released reasonably widely as well. Go see it at the cinema. It does look amazing.
It does, yeah.
On the big screen. Zan Brooks, lovely to have you back. Where have you been?
I've been over in France for a month.
Ah.
It's the home of cinema, you know.
Tarantino really? They respect auteurs there.
They do, and they really do.
Well, it's lovely to have you back. And will you be joining us to review some more films in the coming months?
If I can, if I'm not going to go back to France, I'm not.
You have permission, sir. Lovely to see you, Zan. And don't forget, you can read all of Zan's reviews, interviews and real reviews going to guardian.co.uk/film. From the high operatic drama and violence of Scarface to a more intimate, if no less dramatic, portrayal of death in After School, the feature debut of director Antonio Campos. After School is set in an exclusive East Coast prep school and tells the story of Rob, an introverted 10th grader obsessed with the internet, and who captures on camera the accidental death of two beautiful fellow students.
Hey, Mom.
Hey, honey. What are you doing?
I'm just waiting for lunch to be over.
That's cool.
It's all right. I don't think anyone likes me here, Mom.
Oh, stop. Why do you say that? Everyone loves you. Don't say stupid things like that.
No, I just get this sense that, I don't know, that I'm not, like, really too...
It's 2 years already. Why are you still saying that? What about Dave? Dave's your roommate, right?
Yeah, no, not Dave. I mean, really. But I just get this sense from people, even Dave.
You're ridiculous. Come on. Let's talk about something pleasant.
A clip from After School there. So to tell us more about the film, director Antonio Campos joins me in the Film Weekly studio. Lovely to see you, Antonio. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And congratulations on your debut film, which I have to say was, I thought, extremely unsettling as an experience. It got more unsettling as the film went on. Was that the idea? Did you want to be a sort of scary movie? It's a scary teen movie, but not in the way that that classic Hollywood does it.
Yeah, no, it's a bit of a horror film.
Yeah.
Sometimes I think of it as a present day science fiction film.
And is that I suppose yes. I didn't that didn't occur to me. But in a way, it was sort of like Alien in a way. That haunted house, the prep school is haunted house. The corridors, the kind of the scariness of the institutional walls and lockers.
The drone of the air conditioning or the hard drive. The the sounds that kind of.
Yes, because we don't have the typical teen soundtrack. We don't have the band slam buzz of American indie music going on. We have very much the kind of light switches and cameras. That was definitely an atmosphere decision on your part.
Yes.
And is this because you had a scary that was what you remember of your school? It was a scary place.
No, it's a version of reality and. I want everything to be heightened in a way, so it's grounded in reality, but the atmosphere and the feeling is something a little more heightened.
Right, so we've got Rob, who's a sort of disaffected teen, who's the main protagonist of this film, and he witnesses some deaths in the school. Just pitch me the movie for our listeners who haven't seen it.
The straight pitch, I guess, is a boy goes to a boarding school in the Northeast, and he's kind of obsessed with these images you find online that range from the funny, cute. Images of a baby laughing or a cat playing a piano to the pornographic and violent images of Saddam Hussein hanging or pornography, and he eventually gets into a video class, and his job is to do what the teacher calls B-roll, which is establishing shots of the hallways and the corridors and the classrooms and everything, and he happens to be filming at this moment when two girls die of a drug overdose, and it's completely coincidental. That's from there we take off, and it's how how does the school deal with it and in some ways manipulate this?
And how do its students indeed deal with any emotions? With a shock that even what I like about the film is that when this death happens, we're not even sure it really happens. Is it staged? Is it who's seen it? Who's witnessed it? Who's videoed it? And can teenagers these days even connect with something that happens on their doorstep? Or does it need to connect? Does it need to be something that they've seen on YouTube to connect to? Yeah. There's a lovely moment where they're studying Hamlet. The bit with the plays, the thing wherein I'll catch the conscience of the king. And I thought that was a very sort of smart way of sort of saying, well, I don't know how teenagers would recognise something these days. And is that something, because I mean, you're younger than I am, you work in that film. And I think that the way that movies are going is YouTube clips living clips, not videos. When Rob gets asked, you know, what he likes watching, it's not movies, he likes watching clips.
Yeah.
Is attention span that short these days?
Well, I mean, I think attention spans are going down. I mean, there's no doubt about it, right? What the whole thing about online is that, well, if you feel like watching this, you're going to be able to watch that now.
Yeah.
You know, everything is now, and if in any urge that you get, you need to be ready. You need to be fulfilled quickly. And
absolutely.
So,
and I think in the school environs, this is happening more and more. I mean, we get to see school stuff every day because people are doing girl fight in a hallway.
Yeah, yeah.
You can go on YouTube and see, you know, fights in the playground, which are filmed on mobile phones all the time. I mean, it's
you know, when I finished the film, all these other stories started appearing in the news that were so much worse than anything I could have ever come up with. And one of the stories I remember is a band of cheerleaders, cheerleaders in America. They, one of the girls had said something bad about another girl who was a bit more higher up or more popular or something. And so one of the other cheerleaders invited this bad-mouthing girl over to her house. When she came in, she saw that the whole cheerleading squad was there, and they locked her in, and they started to beat her, each taking their turns, and they filmed it. And the whole point was so that they had a video that they could put on her MySpace page as revenge and say, look at what we did to this girl. And there was a period there where the news was reporting all these stories about teenage girls who would do this either as revenge or sometimes just to see what it looked like when someone bled.
Yeah, absolutely. And we had a spate of films of which I suppose yours reminded me in the finest way. I suppose of Gus Van Sant's Elephant. I was reminded of slightly of. I don't know if that was an influence on your work, and also obviously Michael Haneke's Cachet or Hidden. Yeah. I suppose were two very very kind of great compliments to pay to pay to a work. But there is an influence of these modern masters in there.
Yeah, you know, Haneke is someone that Michael Haneke is probably the most important contemporary director for me. And Gus Van Sant, I think, is one of the most important American independent filmmakers now, and the fact that he does the films that he does. But it was hard for me. I had a feeling that Elephant would be a film that we got compared to very quickly, and I didn't watch Elephant before this film.
Mm.
I didn't want to be inspired too directly by Elephant. But it's a hard film, you know, it's a hard film to not be influenced by.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's like saying, well, you know, it's a genre. High school movies are a genre, and anyone that kind of bucks that genre is an interesting kind of contribution to it. And it isn't like Elephant at all. I think it's a kind of attitude, I suppose.
Yeah, it's an existential teen film that deals with death and violence, and you know, it's when there's not many of them out there, so you kind of, but you know, I think that a lot of the films that he was inspired by going back to like radical European cinema, like, you know, you have Chantal Ackerman in the 70s, and then Bellatar, but you know, the other major film that I know that he was inspired by, or Haris Savitas at least was inspired by, and I can safely say I was looking at the transcript of this documentary every day, was High School by Frederick Wiseman.
Yeah, the great American documentary. And one of your teachers is called Mr. Wiseman. I mean, the video teacher is called Mr. Wiseman. Yeah, it's
not a coincidence.
Right, I was going to say. Yes, of course. That didn't occur to me until now I think of Wiseman, who made this wonderful series of documentaries. He's not so popular in England as he's kind of a keynote filmmaker in America.
Yeah, but he's a filmmaker in America that that up until about, you know, 6 months ago or a year ago, you could only see him in libraries or in retrospectives, and he was like that all over the world. And so he's a documentary filmmaker that is very well known, but he's not up there with like a Maisel brothers because his film is so hard to get. Mm-hmm. But I mean, if you think of if you think about an institution or a kind of I don't know, if you think about, you want to know how a police station works, or you want to know how the hospital works, or a zoo, or something, you'd find a Wiseman film about that thing, and I'm sure it would be almost like going there and spending time with
and it would
people
expose that internal mechanism, which I think your film does beautifully. I mean, what I liked about I've got a note here on my notes that sort of says anti-Juno. I mean, it really is
anti-Juno,
which, I mean, you know, that was supposed to be a quirky indie film. It was kind of, you know, smart mouthed and everything, but this one really is a kind of riposte to that. I mean, teenagers aren't as kind of clued up as that. They're kind of lost. They're kind of moody, but they're kind of smart too. I mean, they know. I think they're kind of discovering their sexuality. Very realistic portrayal of the confusion of teenageness, not just being teenage, but what to do outside the walls of school as well, where this kind of other world exists, and that comes into yours in the form of drugs, I suppose. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of the poison that seeps in to these already quite poisonous minds. Mm-hmm. A really interesting debut. I look forward to seeing what you do next with great interest, because I thought this was a really kind of great contribution to the genre. And I must say, you know, it became creepingly more unsettling until the final shot, which I think is one of the most disturbing images I've seen this year. So for that, thank you, I think. And thank you,
you're welcome.
Thank you for coming into Film Weekly. Antonio Campos, congratulations on After School. After School is on limited release here in the UK from Friday the 21st of August. Up against the hype of the big release of Tarantino's Inglourious Basterds, you could do well to find the quiet, unsettling experience of After School. Well, that's all for another Film Weekly. The music featured in this week's podcast is, of course, taken from Inglourious Basterds' soundtrack. Tarantino can always be relied to come up with a brilliant pastiche of a soundtrack too, including Green Leaves of Summer from John Wayne's The Alamo, and Giorgio Moroder producing David Bowie from Cat People from 1982. It's weird, it's wonderful, and Moroder, of course, did the Scarface soundtrack too. Do pick up a copy of The Observer this Sunday for my trailer trash column and the best film news and reviews. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer on Film Weekly, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye. It's been so long.